Welcome to the Human Experience Podcast, where we have folks of all different walks of life share their trials and tribulations, ideas, cerebral chatter, and experiences. We seek to open minds, shed light, and make our modern world feel a little less lonely, realizing that we are all connected, one human experience at a time. I'm your host, Aisha Billy. I would like to thank you for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy. Welcome, Stan.
Hi, it's good to be here.
It's so good to have you. How you doing today?
It's been a busy day, but it's good. It's good. Every day's good. I'm happy always, you know me.
Wow. If only we could all be as happy as Stan.
Well, I think everybody could if they wanted to.
Say more. That sounds loaded.
Oh, I don't know. A lot of people would probably argue with that, but I think a lot of people probably choose to be maybe in a place that isn't entirely happy all the time. Partly, I think, sometimes because they don't know that it's a choice, and partly sometimes because it's safer, sometimes because of fear. They're afraid to be happy in case somebody takes that happiness away.
I definitely struggle with that.
There are exceptions. I mean, I'm speaking generally, of course. I know that probably 1,000 people, I know you've got 1 million viewers or listeners, so they'll probably call in and say something like, well, there are people that have chemical problems or whatever. So, you know, I'm aware of the exceptions, but I'm just talking generally, you know.
Yeah, of the things that we actually can control.
Yeah, particularly in this business. You know, we're in movies where most people spend their whole lives just sitting around waiting for a phone call.
Yeah. For sure.
It's all about rejection and all that kind of stuff. So unless you have a good positive perspective on life, you know, then, you know, you go in the other direction.
So for me, one of, like, you really saw my journey here with, like, when I literally first got here to now. And you've seen how much I've changed. And I think one of the biggest things for me, and I'm still grappling, I'm still learning. I don't want it to come off like I've figured everything out.
No.
But it's where I can choose to, like, picking and choosing what I'm going to get so frustrated over and what I'm going to let go.
Yeah.
And I hit, like, a good patch where I felt like I was thriving. Like, the past 2 weeks, I felt like I was fucking on top of the world. Things clicked. Things made sense. I understood why I went through the bullshit I went through. And then I have that fear that I'm like, it's only a matter of time until it comes crashing down. So then I can't even lean into the happiness as much as I want to.
But then, that's not life to always have everything work in your favor. I mean, part of being kind of like primarily happy all the time is understanding that there's going to be good times and bad times.
Yeah.
And what keeps you happy in the bad times is knowing that that's not permanent either. You know, it'll always go up and it'll always go down. And then when you're on a down, like, for example, there are people that are stress over something that might happen.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm
like, they're worried about, and it's like, oh, they didn't return the call, or this didn't happen, or I didn't get the funding for this or whatever. And they sweat and they sweat and they make themselves miserable, maybe sometimes for weeks, if not days, you know, or vice versa. And then suddenly it works out sometimes to be in their favor. And I always go to them, see, you just wasted 2 days or 2 weeks of your life destroying your soul when you had no idea you were going to get this. You could have been happy and you would have saved yourself all that
misery. Or just, like, even if not happy, you could have just been, like, living, going about your life, not having this, like, going crazy experience. I actually have such a good example of that. In class, like in an acting class, you know, you work on your whatever material it is, and maybe you'll get to go today, or maybe you won't come up today and some other student will go. But you are, like, so nervous. This has happened to me so much in class where I'm sitting there and I'm, like, nervous because I'm going to go today.
Yeah.
And I cannot tell you how many days we didn't end up getting around to me. So I just sat through that entire class, an anxious wreck, and then I didn't even have to go. So I was like, I'm done being anxious.
Right.
Like, it's not worth it.
Right.
Like, the amount of times that I have been anxious where we just didn't get to me and then we picked up with me the next day was countless. So I was like, this isn't worth it. So that is like an example that comes to mind.
Well, for me, it's like one of the reasons I'm always early. Like, if I have an audition, I'll go an hour early. So by the time you're sitting there for 30 minutes, 45 minutes, you get so sick and tired of being stressed.
Yeah.
That you actually calm down a little bit. You know, I think if you're going at the last minute, I mean, you don't have a chance to really quell those nerves.
That's like what I mean, though. Like, you don't want, like, it sucks. Like, you get sick of it.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I spun myself out in anxiety as much as I could.
Yeah.
And I was just done.
It happened to me, actually, with the relationship. I remember one day, it's just like, you know, when you break up and it's not your choice, usually you're miserable and you're horrible. And I remember being miserable all the time. And, well, I always tried to hide it from people, but, you know, in your own private space. And I'll never forget the day that I was actually, because I slept on a couch. I was facing the actual back part of the couch and I'm staring at the wall of the back, you know, the couch. And I thought to myself, oh my God, I'm just so sick and tired of being miserable. And that was it. And I realized I had that switch where I can actually work myself into being sick of being tired or sick of being, miserable or sick of being anxious. And, you know, so it kind of alerts you to the fact that it is a switch and you can choose to think the other way. It's not human
for
things not to creep in occasionally.
Of course, yeah.
But I mean, it's like, yeah, I mean, it's just human nature to feel everything. But I think it takes experience and wisdom only comes with experience and life experience to know that there are ways to actually to lessen the pain. Look, people hate cliches because they're cliches, but they're also a very basic truth. And there's that old cliche, I'm sure you've heard it, that says those people that are depressed are those that are living in the past. Those that are anxious are the ones that are living in the future. And those that are happy are those that are living in the present. Because the past and the future don't exist. Nothing, I mean, it doesn't. The future hasn't happened yet. So you don't know, like we said before. I mean, you might get that job or you might get that call or that thing might happen. So the anxiety waiting for that, you know, was wasted.
But what are your thoughts?
The past has happened too.
On past experiences that have had a lingering effect that need to be processed.
Well, yeah, they need to be processed, but it's not going to happen. It's not that that it's happening now. What's happening now, the only thing that's real, really, in all honesty, the only thing that's real is what's happening here between you and me.
Yeah. I mean, I'll agree with that outside of trauma. Like, if something, a traumatic thing happens, your brain stores it and can make it feel like it's still happening now.
True. But then some people choose to focus on that. And what I'm saying is, it's just where you focus. Are you going to focus on that? You're talking about processing. So you're going to process 24 hours a day for the rest of your life on something that happened in the past? No. You process it. You go through it. It creeps in occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to learn where to put your focus. That's why they have, again, another cliche, you know, the glass half full, glass half empty thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you're either going to be, like somebody posted, I think I told you this the other day on Facebook, what is the key to happiness? Because I thought, well, I should chime in on this because people always tell me, oh, you're always happy, you're always smiling. I say it's just gratitude, because if you're grateful for everything you have and don't focus on the things that you don't have, then you're essentially going to be a happy person. If you only focus on the things that you don't have or you can't get or haven't got yet or that you're striving for, you're constantly going to be anxious and miserable. And everybody's going to have that. Doesn't matter at what level they're at. And there's always somebody worse off.
You know?
There's always somebody worse
off. And just to clarify, like, to the listeners, obviously, like, if you've had a traumatic experience, you have PTSD, or you had a loss, that's different if you're, like, grieving.
Yeah.
I think we're talking more about, like,
we're talking
day-to-day,
about,
generally.
You can always take it, you can always, you know, be anecdotal and say, well, what about the person that, you know, went to Iraq and ended up, you know, getting blown up or something.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a different thing altogether.
Yeah.
I mean, we're surrounded by a bunch of people who have no reason to feel the way they do. A perfect example is you watch something like the Academy Awards, right? And you see one person miserable, you know, and everybody complaining that one person won an award and the other person didn't because one was more deserving. I'm thinking, these people are living lives that we can only dream of having. They've got mansions, they've got millions of dollars, and they vote for themselves. It's not like the public voted for them. They vote for themselves. They're about the most privileged people, or the prince and the princess, for example, you know, that are trying to get into the royal family. They're already princes and princesses, and people are chiming in on this, feeling bad for someone that has more money, more wealth, more fame, more of everything than we could ever possibly have, and yet they're still focused on what they don't have instead of everything that they have that nobody else has, you know, like less than 1%. They talk about the 1%. That's probably a fraction of 1% that have anything even close to what those people have. And yet they're miserable. They're talking about, you know, feeling like suicidal or whatever. I'm thinking, really? I mean, yeah, everybody feels, everybody's human. But if you focus on the things that you have and how you've been blessed by God to have all these things in your favor. No matter how you got there, you've got them now.
Yeah, I definitely think that gratitude is a huge, huge help in general. Like, no matter who you are, whatever, where in the world. And I know Brené Brown is someone who she's a professor, I believe, taught at Texas A&M, but basically had a TED Talk years ago and completely blew up after that. So I don't even know if she still teaches out of school. Mm-hmm. She was a psychology professor, I believe. Her specialty was in vulnerability and not bravery, vulnerability and...
courage?
Yes. Mm. Yeah, actually. And she talked about the difference between... I don't know if it was like folks who struggle and folks who don't, but she said that gratitude is actually like practicing gratitude is actually one of the absolute most beneficial things that anyone can do for their mental health. I will tell you, I maturing, and I didn't recognize how hard gratitude, it's not as hard for me anymore, but I didn't realize that I really wasn't grateful. Mm-hmm. And there's just so much that I did grow up without. Right. I moved around a lot, like single family, single parent, household, mom never home. I was oldest, like I was constantly around kids who had more or less responsibility. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that's where it stemmed from, where now in my adult life, I still have demons that haunt me. But I have the job, I'm living in LA, I have a car that'll get me around. Like, I feel pretty settled out now.
Right.
And I still would find myself struggling with being grateful because I was so fixated on what I didn't have. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I just, like, when I'm feeling frustrated, that's when gratitude is so hard for me. Like, when I'm just feeling angry and festered, I just want to be like, fuck it all, and, like, just be destructive, you know? But I want to say what you're talking about comes in time and experiences, as you said.
It's
emotional maturity, what you're talking about.
But even the emotional maturity teaches you that you can't stop yourself from being angry or being bitter or being jealous or being any of those negative feelings. Mm-hmm. You can't just deny that you feel them. Otherwise, you're not really, you're denying.
Your human experience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But... it's a matter of processing it and not dwelling on it, you know? And for me, I mean, it's different for everybody. For me, it's just like sometimes if I know that I'm really annoyed by something or pissed off by something or really disappointed by something, whatever the feeling is, if it's something that's really strong, I think, okay, well, I've got to live through this for today, but tomorrow I'm going to wake up and everything's going to, it'll be out. That's it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to allow myself
to feel
today to feel shitty. And usually by the time I get to the end of the day, I say, well, you're done with it now?
Yeah. I can fester for a long time. If I really get angry, I could sit on that for the whole day. Unfortunately, like I can't kick it off quickly. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I wrote heading into this new year, I was just reflecting. I said, you can't avoid negative feelings as a human. Like, it's impossible to never not feel bad shit.
No, you wouldn't be able to be an actor if you didn't understand what that feeling was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I often tell actors that it's like acting and life is so similar in the sense that it's like walking on a tightrope. You know what a tightrope is? Have you ever seen a
slack?
You've been to a circus, right?
Mm-hmm.
And tightrope is that rope that those guys walk on. Mm-hmm. Well, when they walk on it, what gives them balance?
Themselves?
No, you can't balance yourself. They're usually holding something, aren't they?
Oh.
They're holding that huge beam, right?
Okay.
You know, that long stick?
Yeah.
And so basically as they're walking, they tip it to one side to distribute the weight, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, for example, people that walk through life not wanting to get hurt, protecting themselves, for example, from a relationship. They put that brick wall around themselves.
That's me, by the
way. They're protecting themselves from pain and agony.
Me.
But when you do that, you're walking on that tightrope with a pencil, not like a 20-foot beam. And so you have no balance because without understanding what true agony is, I don't think you can truly experience ecstasy because you don't have the difference, you know.
Yeah.
You see people in class, for example, you do acting class, right? You see people all the time that are fairly green, that have just started, And the teacher says, no, it's bigger than that. You're angrier than that, or you're sadder than that, or whatever. And they go, well, I'm screaming as much as I can. It's not about screaming, and you haven't gone as far as you can go. Trust me, you can go further. But you haven't really let go into whatever that ecstasy is or that agony is.
The depth.
You need the contrast
so
that you have the appreciation and the gratitude. You can't really appreciate the ecstasy without having had a taste of the agony. And when you close yourself off, you never really give yourself that balance.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So yeah.
I think a lot about depth a lot. And I appreciate recognizing that I'm a deep person. That's something that I fought for a long time. Because I was like, I don't want to be deep. I want to be like the rest of these superficial people. Not saying everybody else is superficial. What I mean is people who are a bit more surface or lighter or whatever. And I kept fighting it and fighting it and fighting it. And then I finally said, no, I'm a deep person. I'm done fighting that. And if somebody's uncomfortable around it, I just won't express it around them. And then I will find people who are my trenches people who want to go into the trenches with me. And those are the ones that I will go
with. Well, I had a friend. I won't mention names. But I had a friend. He was new here. He was a very good-looking kid, you know. And he was like you, a really decent, deep person. And he kept finding that he couldn't seem to attract girls, you know, and he didn't understand what the problem was, you know. And I said, well, one, you only recently got here, so you got to get to know more people for a start. But the other thing is, too, is that I said, you know, maybe they just don't appreciate you for who you are. He goes, you know what I see? So he keeps pointing, to people who we both knew.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I've come to realize that I've just got to be an asshole, you know, that old treat them mean and keep them keen type thing, you know. He says, I'm just going to be a dick from now on. I said, well, why do that? Why are you lowering yourself to the gutter? Why not just stay? It's better to be where you are, stay where you are, because that's naturally who you are.
Yep.
You're changing your nature.
You're denaturing yourself.
But you won't be able to because it's ingrained in you. In the end, it crops up, you know. I said, let the cream rise to the top. Let them earn you. You know, if you're not meeting the right people, you're not supposed to meet them just like that. They happen randomly. You know, it happens when you least expect it. But I think when you're new in a place, sometimes what happens is that the first thing you want to do is make friends, you know.
Have you read The Golden Boy?
I was in the play.
Okay. So what was the boy's name? Very Italian.
Yeah, yeah. Now you got me thinking. Joe.
Joe, okay. So The Golden Boy, 1937 New York, Italian family.
Yeah.
Joe is the son of an Italian immigrant.
Yeah.
And that play is about many things, but one thing in particular is about denaturing yourself. And he was a violinist who was also good at fighting.
Yeah.
I believe had, and I would think you agree, had more of an affinity towards violin, but had such a chip on his shoulder to prove himself, to make money, that he was doing prize fighting. And I won't give the ending away, but he did I think he fought his nature pretty hard.
Well, it was a story about art versus commerce, you know.
Versus what?
Commerce. Commerce, like money.
Money, yeah.
Money versus art.
Passion and practicality.
So I think it's something that, It's good for actors to watch, because sometimes it's like my favorite movie, It's a Wonderful Life. It's about what's more important. Is it, you know, Sam Wainwright, who went away and became a millionaire, or was it George Bailey, who stayed in, you know, Bedford Falls and really had a very humble home and family, and George felt like he was useless, and he asked his wife, why did you choose me when you could have had Sam Wainwright, you could have had anybody? She said, because I wanted my baby to look like you. And then he realizes she's pregnant and they're going to have kids, and he never really appreciated his achievements because he measured it as a comparison to somebody else who had commerce or had money, you know. And then he thought he was worth more dead than alive because, you know, he got into trouble. He covered for his uncle who lost some money, and he said that he lost it. And everyone's saying, what did you do? Did you gamble it away or whatever? And he just thought it'd be easier to kill himself because his family could have his health, his life insurance. So again, it's money versus, you know, life and humanity. And then the angel comes down, of course, and shows him that all the things that would never have happened had he not lived, and how his brother would have died because he wouldn't have been there to save him when he was 8 years old in the lake, and how hundreds of war veterans would have died instead of being veterans if he hadn't saved his brother, who went and saved all these other people from he shot down a kamikaze pilot during World War II. And he goes through all these things, and in the end he says, see, George, you really did have a wonderful life. Mm. You know what I mean? And he starts to realize that, not everything's measured by commerce and what you acquire and whatever. That's why I wrote the book about that for actors called The Hollywood Bible. So there's a short plug there. Sorry about that.
No, tell us about it.
It's called The Hollywood Bible. It's on Amazon for people that want to get it. But it's not an acting book, and it's not a directing book or a filmmaking book, which is, what people know me for. It really was a way to let people know that you can maintain your dreams and you can maintain your spirit and your soul, and it's a guide to that, of how to do that, because nobody teaches you that at schools. Nobody really, there's no path in this business that helps you to understand that everyone has a different path. You can't just go to school, get a degree, and suddenly you're an actor, and nobody understands why some people make it and some people don't, because some people have no talent, some people have mega talent, and neither of those things seem to really make a difference to the outsider. There's a lot of other things going on. So basically, without giving the book away, because there's 10 chapters in it, I mean, the essence of the book is to tell you that the inspiration needs to come from within. And you only have that if you have a passion for what you do and you love what you're doing and you learn to love the journey of what this is, like doing these podcasts or doing auditions or doing the headshots. If you make that a misery, then you're going to quit at some point. Mm-hmm. If you love creating and you love making your own films and your own videos and taking new shots and doing all these things, learn to love the process. That's what's going to be 90% of your time, because the film only takes 12 weeks to shoot and you're only a part of it, so you might only be there for 2 or 3 days and then you're waiting for another project,
100%.
Or if you're on a TV show, might go for a season or a few seasons, but then you might be sitting around for a few years. Look at those Brady Bunch kids, they did that series and they just couldn't get any other work after that. But then some of them learned through time that they could look back and be grateful that they were recognized for anything. Some people are never recognized for nothing at all, for anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
They at least had some time in the limelight where nobody was bigger than them. And some of them were grateful for that. And those people remained happy. The other ones, they got bitter about it and couldn't let go of it, had a hard time.
Totally. God. So your main inspiration behind writing your book, would you say, is mainly how to keep a dream alive, or did you struggle with surviving out here in Hollywood? Spirit, like as you, human you.
It was easier for me. It was a hard struggle. I mean, people that know my story know that I was homeless and penniless.
When did you get here?
I got here in 94.
Okay.
So I've been here nearly 30 years now. It'll be 30 years next year.
Walk us through a little bit.
Well, it's too long a story, but in a nutshell, when I got here, I didn't think I would, I was doing two things. I was curious about acting, and I'd lost my nerve because, I'd been in a relationship and I hadn't acted for a while. So, but I knew if I brought myself to Hollywood, I'd have to look at it. You know what I mean? So that was always the goal, to go to the top. And then I was also training. So, I used to buy two magazines. One was called Health and Fitness, and the other one was called Dramalog, which is later became Backstage West, and now it's all online. So it had castings and stuff in it. And I saw two ads, and it was like, one was for being certified as a physical trainer and a personal trainer, and I thought, oh, I wonder, I could probably afford that. And the other one was for this school. I always, because I was a movie buff, I grew up knowing everything about old movies, I wonder what that's like, So I made the call there first, and they said, why don't you come in for an interview? And instantly, you know what it's like. It's just like when you walk into a store, can I help you? Oh, no, I'm just looking, And so when they say, come in and have a tour, I was, and then I just stopped myself. I don't know what stopped me. I said, oh, okay. So I came in and I saw the place, and I'm going, oh my God, this is what I've always wanted. And I can start at the beginning and learn a technique instead of just trying to wing it and whatever. So I was quite happy to start at the beginning again, she told me how much it was, and I knew I could get through a semester. I said to her, I think I could probably afford one semester. but I don't think I'd be able to go on after that. And she goes, well, you know what? I could only afford one class when I first came here, and look at me now.
Hmm.
And I thought, there's something in the way that she said that. She wasn't pushing it. She was being sincere. She was working in the office, and I was thinking, And so I thought, okay, so I gave the last penny I had to them. And I went, and then I ran out of money, and basically by that, in that 3 months, because the semesters then were 3 months, this place was new at that time because they'd moved from near the Pantages where there was a fire, and then the city bought that part of the land to make the railway station. They moved here to Hollywood and Highland, and there's this massive building, but half the building wasn't being used because they had just moved in, you know, and a lot of the people had left, and so there was only a skeleton staff, and so they had nobody to do a lot of stuff. So I just, because I had nothing else to do and I wasn't allowed to work, I was a student, I just did everything around the place. I built all the people you see building sets, I built the sets. All the people you see doing the lights, I built the lights. The people you see doing post-secondary, I did that. People at the desk, there was only one, me, day and night, 7 days a week, everything. I did everything. I'd come, and because I would just rather be in the element, you know, be in the environment than what? Go home?
I totally home, agree you know? With you. The environment begets a lot.
But I didn't just sit here like you see a lot of people do. I worked. I literally learned how to make a set. I learned how to do lights. I learned how to do all these things, which is kind of what led to making movies eventually. And when I ran out of money, you know, I didn't want to be one of these people that would sneak into class, and because they had no idea of everybody that was going on. I probably could have slipped by a few without them realizing I hadn't paid. But they'd been so good to me, I couldn't do it. And I went into the lady who was running the school at the time, Irene Gilbert, and I said, Irene, I know I picked my classes, but I don't think I should go because I really don't have a penny. And she said, well, how much have you got? I said, I don't have anything. She said, you don't have anything? I said, no, I'm about to move into my car too because I can't afford the rent either. So I really won't be able to come up with it. She goes, well, just go to class tonight and come and see me tomorrow and we'll talk about it. And I kind of was reluctant to, but I didn't want to argue with her, you know, because I thought, I don't want to start something that I can't finish, you know. So I went to my class for that evening. I came back the next day and she goes, so what's happening? I said, well, nothing. It's the same. She goes, oh, okay. Well, she said, Gail wants to give you a scholarship. Gail Ross was my speech teacher. She's the she was the mother of Gary Ross, and most people would know him. He's a writer-director that made Pleasantville and Hunger Games and Seabiscuit, and major, major player, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And his mother was my speech teacher. She wanted me in her class. I said, okay. And she goes, just go to your other classes too, and we'll see what we can do about that. And I ended up just going to all my classes, and they never charged me. They basically gave me a full scholarship for everything but the first semester. And in terms of my living, well, basically I moved into my car. The day I moved into my car, one of the teachers had heard about that because I was trying to figure out, I was asking around, where's a safe place to park, you know?
Mm.
And so they basically told Irene, and Irene said, come with me. And I thought, damn, I'm in trouble. And she took me back here to one of these rooms in the back, and she goes, well, we don't want you sleeping in your car, so why don't you just be all night security here, you know? And I lived in this building in a room with no windows, no air conditioning, no hot water, no shower, just four concrete walls. But to me, it was like heaven. And I lived there for 20 years.
Wow.
And I got my green card. I'm a citizen now. But you know what? There was 1,000 times in between. I've had guns pointed at me. I've had a lot of things happen, you know. So there was a lot of times where I could have said, you know what? I tried everything. I mean, nobody would have looked at me twice for going back. They would have said, dude, you tried, you know. But I knew I wasn't going, there was no way I was going to go back, you know. And it just,
to Australia,
just, yeah, it just all fell into place. And I think that, you know, if you want something badly enough, whatever is meant to be for you is meant to be for you. Now obviously I'm not on the grid, so people don't know my name, I'm not famous or anything. But maybe that wasn't my path, you know, or maybe it hasn't happened yet. But that's why I talk about, you know, embrace the journey. And don't look at the result. I mean, for me at the time, I was thinking if I could just stay in this country legally and earn a living, you know, I would be so grateful. I'd have everything. But, you know, you get that and then you start thinking of other things, you know. So you have to basically put everything into perspective and again, you know, realize that some of the things we have, there's a million other people that don't have what we have. And I keep going back to that, but that's kind of, it explains, you know, my personality and why I'm always happy, because I try to constantly appreciate the fact that, you know, I could still walk around, everything's still working. I'd have a movie that just came out, you know, I've written
plug a couple it in. Of books. What's the film?
The movie's called Cash.
It's Where can we find it?
It's on Amazon. Cash, and it's about a couple of motorcyclists.
So you're a director as well?
I'm a filmmaker. I'm a guerrilla filmmaker, mm-hmm. you know. So, again, it's like when I won my first award, I almost fainted on the way to the stage. You know, my knees were weak. I never thought I'd be able to walk onto a stage and win an award for something, you know, for writing, you know. And since then, I've probably been nominated 100 times, and I got about 30, 40 awards and for writing, producing, directing, or whatever. But they're all guerrilla films. They're not films that, you know, you could run off the tip of your tongue yeah. and just say, oh, that film, I saw that film. No, it's just guerrilla films. But you know what? Everything is a step towards something else.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's creating art, and it's putting my friends to work. It's putting me to work, and yep. it's including everybody. I think if you watch the Kennedy Center Awards, it's the same thing on an extremely different level when you talk about Adam Sandler. When you hear the people, the comedians, talking about how he gave them an opportunity and brought them in and kept it a family thing and they all grew together. And I think that that's what I'm trying to do, but yeah. just on a much lower scale. But the intent is the same, you mm-hmm. know.
Absolutely. I like, my heart is like where you describe of, I'm just there for the thing. I don't need the accolades. I would love the money. I don't need the fame. I don't need, like, whatever it is. I need to be expressing the thing mm-hmm. that's within me that needs to be expressed.
Right.
I have lived my life fighting that. Does not work for me. Mm-hmm. I think you've seen me where I just felt like complete shit. And those were the times that I was fighting certain parts of myself. So for me, again, that creating with your friends,
mm-hmm.
that's huge for me. Creating, period, that's huge for me. It's not an option to have the art sit inside of me. It's really not. It's spiritual death for me.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime I'm doing that to myself, anyone can tell. I've had several people at different times say to me, are you okay? Like, you lost your glow. You don't mm-hmm. have your glow. And it's funny that they all said glow, because you can literally see it from the outside when I'm not expressing the way that I need to be expressing. So putting all of that, like, big names that you could rattle off from your head at home, or the money or the mm-hmm. accolades and stuff, it's about making art, and that is essentially for you. It's for your soul at the end mm-hmm. of the day. It's yeah. not for, you know, getting caught up. And what you said, like, you hit a salary that you've wanted to hit for so long, and you're happy. And then you're like, great, another 20,000. Another, can we hit six figures? It yeah. never stops.
No, it never stops.
It never stops.
It's human nature.
Exactly. And there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
I want to honor that.
Right.
But it's good to kind of do what you said, where you, how did you put it? I guess it's like gratitude, essentially, where you say, let's be thankful for what we do have, because if we want to keep climbing the ladder, there is no ending mark.
No. It's embracing the process is what
yeah,
I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
Embrace totally. The process, and then whatever's, if you work your ass off, you'll get what you deserve. Nobody knows what that is.
Yeah.
And the thing is that, you know, it's like in that book that I wrote, the very first chapter is identifying whether you're an artist or not before you get involved in something like this. Because if you are, you won't be able to walk away from it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first sign. You can try to walk away from it, but you won't. It'll drag you back in. If you're enthused by writing that scene that everybody repeats or does in class for year after year after year, you become that Arthur Miller, or to write that lyric that everyone keeps singing in their head, or to do that painting that gets repeated 1,000 times over as a print, you know,
mm-hmm. Or just analyzing films,
whatever. Or, you know, that's an artist, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If you're focused on how famous you could be, how many followers you can have, how much money
you're done.
You're gonna get done real quick.
You're done.
Because you won't be able to put up with the, unless you're lucky, which, because that can happen too. Generally speaking, you'll get done in quick time, because the pressure of a business that has no rules and no path that Like, for example, I tell people, if anyone tells you this is how you make it, they're lying to you. Yeah. Stop listening to this, because nobody knows.
It's a guru trying to sell you something too, probably.
All I tell people, and that's why my book is not doesn't say, you know, it's not advice. It's just my opinion, and I'm just sharing my opinion. That's why I say it's a testament by Stan Harrington to, you know, play with words. It's not really a biblical book, even though it's called the Hollywood Bible. It's just my testament or my experience sharing with somebody else or with an audience on how to maintain your spirit and your soul, you know. And really what I'm telling people more than anything is that the answers are already in you.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about it, how many times, you know, with this social media, you see people always putting up quotes, you know. And I see it all the time. Somebody will be sitting there and they go, oh, my God, that's so true, that's so true. And often I'll chime in. I'm going, how do you know? How do you know it's true? That all that glitters is not gold. If you're saying, oh, that's so true, it's because you have a recognition for it. That means you have that knowledge in you.
Mm.
So all the knowledge we need is already in us. Sometimes you do need somebody outside to say it. So you go, you know what, I knew.
Yes, to ring the bell.
But the key, you know, this will stop you from buying the book, because really this is the key to the book.
No, it won't.
The key is the knowledge is already in you. So use your time to learn how to plumb that out yourself so that you can inspire yourself, so you don't need somebody else to inspire you. Be inspired by their greatness, but not because you need them to inspire you to do what you need to do. You know, I'm always inspired by art, but I don't need that to drive me.
Mm-hmm.
I use myself to kind of find a way to inspire myself to do better, and then use that as an external.
That beginning part of the word knowledge is know.
Yes.
There was this... Because
knowledge is power, and power is what will give you control.
And it's the inner knowing, like what you were talking about. Mm-hmm. When I first finished high school, there was this college guidance counselor, I guess. That was her position, who's now passed away too young. Rest in peace to her. I was working with her in this program for kids who just graduated high school, and they were starting college. It was over the summer, and it was called the Summer Bridge, bridging you from senior year of high school to freshman year of college. And it was for kids who were first generation college and low income, a lot of like immigrant kids or children of immigrants like myself. And I've been working a lot since I was 15. Like, anytime, like, I have, like, work addiction. Like, I just work. And when I met her, I was working, I think, 3 jobs. Dunkin' Donuts, lifeguarding at LA Fitness, and one more gig, I can't remember. And she was like, why do you work so much? And I was like, I don't know. And she was like, yes, you do. And it's that. It's exactly what you said. The knowing is in you.
It's in you. You don't need somebody else to tell
you
how to
do it. And I was so stunned when she said that to me. And I was 18, you know, it was a thing that, this is like a Turkish expression where you give somebody like, you know, a piece of advice and you say, keep it as an earring on your ear.
Uh-huh.
And that became an earring on my ear because I couldn't unpack it then. And then I unpacked it as years and years went on, where my soul was just in agony in my human experience because I was fighting my nature. I wanted to be doing the arts. I wanted to be being creative. And I still have my 9-to-5, but I just wasn't allowing myself to create at all. It was so black and white. I was like, no, if I'm not doing art fully, I can't do it at all. Punishing myself destroyed me. But I always say to myself now, when you don't feel like you know, you do know. You just have to connect to source, connect to God, connect to the higher
self.
Whatever
you believe in.
Whatever it is, connect to a tree. Go sit in nature. I go in nature when I need grounding and I find a tree. I sit at the stump of a tree, talk out loud, write, whatever.
Yeah.
Especially now with the phones, distraction is so accessible to us. We're distracting. We're not processing our emotions. We go to bed and we either can't sleep when the head hits the pillow because all the emotions, all the things, the knowing that we haven't processed, it's waiting for us. Or when you wake up in the morning, it's waiting for you there. So I make it a point now to have my do nothing time where I sit, I meditate, just check in what's going on. So I think that's a really good piece of advice. I did want to ask something specific though.
Yeah.
How would you say somebody can find out if they are an artist or not?
Well, like I say, you can walk away from it, but it'll drag you back. There's no way you can't walk. It's in your blood.
Is there like
it identifies you in many ways. Like a friend of mine that I made a movie for, who was a musician, when he came, he was from Canada, and he came down again because we got a radio interview, and he was really miserable. I said, what's the matter? He'd just broken up with his girlfriend, and he was really miserable about it, but he said it was probably for the best. And I was saying, well, why would you say that? I mean, that's just because he was younger than me. I'm thinking that's a pretty profound thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, because she didn't like my music. And I go, oh, and I was waiting for the rest of it. And he goes, and, you know, that's okay not to like my music, but anybody who knows me knows that I am my music.
Yeah.
See? Now, most people that know me know that I am my art.
Mm-hmm.
You know, an artist is defined by his art in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like a teacher said to me when I that girl, actually it was the lady that gave me the scholarship, Gail Ross. You know, she said to me, what's your favorite film and who are your favorite actors? I said, It's a Wonderful Life. My favorite actors are Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart. She goes, well, that's who you will be like. And I'm thinking, I didn't see that because, I mean, I know your audience won't be able to see my face, but I'm a pretty craggy sort of a guy, you know, look like an old biker type dude sort of thing.
How funny is that?
And then I looked different, but I still was a character face, not a leading man, which is something that a lot of actors can't seem to, like every male guy thinks he's an action star, every girl thinks she's a model, so I think you got to really be honest with yourself, that's one thing. But didn't really make sense to me, you know, and then as time went on, I realized that she was speaking figuratively, not specifically, because Cary Grant's a leading man, you know, plays himself, you know. And Jimmy Stewart's the all-American guy, and I'm a Greek-Australian that looks like a Mediterranean sort of a dude, you know. So, but I realized it was more an aura and a sense and what they represent that she was talking about. And, yeah, when you look at It's a Wonderful Life, that's exactly, I mean, that defines who I am, you know, the guy who appreciates that, you know, we're all connected.
It's an influence. No man is poor
who has friends, you know.
Yeah, I agree with that completely.
And the other thing, and a lot of this, like I say, I mean, it saves you getting the book. A lot of it's in there. If you're really an artist, you don't put a time limit on it anyway, you know, because the thing is that one of the greatest artists of modern history is Van Gogh. I mean, he died a pauper. He couldn't sell a painting. They thought he was a hack, you know. Now, if you don't have at least, I don't know, $10, $20 million, you can't buy just a little tiny print of his, you know, because now he's considered an artistic genius.
Look at Emily Dickinson.
Yeah, but the point I'm making about that is that he was ahead of his time. He hadn't even found his audience yet. He died before he found his audience.
Yeah.
So if you're going to put a time limit on it, you may as well quit now. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Sure. Well, it's the same with Emily Dickinson. Yeah. She was, I think, in her room for 20 years.
Yes.
Going inward and inward and inward. She is one of the most profound poets in history.
Yes.
And it was after she died, I believe. And they went into her room and dug up all her poems.
So you don't know. You can't judge your talent by your success necessarily. Mm. You know what I mean?
Because it might happen after
you And that's die. Why you got to separate the two. Exactly. Yeah. Well, you got to separate the two and just know that if you're doing the work. I think an example that I use, and I won't take up too much time because I know you're near the end here, but someone like, if you separate it from art for a second, just think of sports, like in basketball, you know, Kobe Bryant, God rest his soul, who passed away, you know what I mean? He was like a shooter. He was this incredible shooter, you know, and there was a time, I can't remember what it was, he shot like 60 or 70 free throws all consecutively, you know? Now, there was a time when he missed like four or five in a row, and it's just like, did he stop shooting? No, because he knew he had done the work.
Yeah.
And if you do the work and you're a shooter, you keep shooting because you know it's going to come back. There's going to be times when it's up and times when it's down.
It's human. We're human. That's why.
Exactly.
It's human.
So, yeah. And in art, there is no perfection. So if you're looking for perfection and you're just never going to be satisfied, then you're never going to be satisfied. You've got to understand that art is not something you can perfect because it's always one of the key elements in determining the value of art is audience response. And you cannot determine what an audience thinks of your work. You can't force people to like what you do. Every film that you can imagine, I don't care what it is, has somebody that hates it. You know, even the best film of all time or your favorite film, you know, It's a Wonderful Life, for example, was not really well looked upon when it was made. Now it's a national classic.
Yeah.
So, you know.
So your two pieces that we could find, you got the Hollywood Bible.
Yeah.
On Amazon.
Yes.
And then your film now, Cash
yeah.
on
Amazon.
Yeah. On Amazon yeah. as well. Anything else that you want to share? Any more of your pieces?
No, not really. I mean, they're the most recent. I mean, anyone who finds that will probably find other stuff of mine too, like Bella or Lost Angels or any of those. They're all on Amazon. So if anything catches their attention, I'm sure they'll follow through and watch something else. If not, then, you know, it's probably they didn't like what I did, but that's the way art works, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
It's not for everyone.
Well, thank you so much.
It was a pleasure.
For coming on.
It was fun.
Yes. Anytime.
And that's a wrap on today's episode. Thank you for tuning in. Please share, subscribe, give us a 5-star rating if you gain anything at all from today's podcast, and we look forward to having you back next.